Uncle Don here with Porcupine Petting Zoo number 278. The home station is CFUR at 88.7 FM and rebroadcasts on CHLS in Lillooet and CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake. My late brother was always obsessed by numbers. When he was little, he would annoy the family whenever we drove by reading aloud all house numbers, street numbers, and license plate numbers. Later, he began a project of typing numbers in sequence on our old portable typewriter. Before he finished, he'd used scads of paper and was well up into the thousands. While studying computer science in college, he sent me a program, he wrote, that would rapidly fill screen after screen by counting from one to a million. Brother John enjoyed big numbers, and his death prevented him from contemplating one biggie in the news these days. That is, 100 billion. That's about the number in Yankee dollars that the seven largest Wall Street investment banks wrote off in bad loans over the past year. $100 billion is also roughly the amount the U.S. government has sent out in their so-called stimulus checks to every taxpayer and Social Security recipient, including your Uncle Don. This stimulus infusion is intended to promote spending, creating jobs, and restoring confidence of consumers, although it appears that only 10% of this money is being blown on new purchases, with the rest paying down debt or just being eaten up by inflation. Since the U.S. government is running a huge deficit, this $100 billion it is throwing at citizens is exactly the amount that must be solicited from savers, mostly foreign, by issuing more treasury bills, hence more debt to be repaid in the future, with interest, another $100 billion in the hole. Over the last 4 years, America's big banks have, according to the New York State Comptroller's Office, paid their executives bonuses totaling, guess, about $100 billion. These bonuses were for performance in creating and flogging the same dubious mortgages and bonds that are now collapsing and requiring government intervention. Those executives created phony inflated assets in order to milk their employers and the economy of that vast amount of money. Now, they have it now and can laugh at the destruction they have caused. Here we have the results in round numbers of what passes for free, as in free markets. It means free of regulation, free of responsibility, free of morality. And thanks to the Reagan-Bush gutting of the tax structure, it means that the $100 billion soaked out of the economy by wheeler dealers will return little to government, which must pay for the damage. Leave it to the little guy still working for a living, if he or she is lucky, to cough up the money to pay the bills, or their children, or grandchildren, or great-grandchildren. Here's an update on the case of the Canadian trapped in our Sudanese embassy. His name is Aboussoufiane Abdelrazik, a name I shall not try to repeat often. 2 weeks ago, I mentioned his situation in relation to deterioration of the value of Canadian citizenship once one has left our national territory. He was on holiday in Sudan when arrested by local police at Canadian request and held in lockup until his passport expired. He was mistreated, of course, but then released by the Sudanese, who considered him innocent. This man has been charged with no crime in Sudan or Canada. Canadian officials have referred to him as an Islamic extremist, a term once applied to Meir Arar, kidnapped by Americans and sent to Syria for torture. They reveal no evidence of this status. He's trapped in that odd limbo of those suspected of ties to terrorists. According to our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, he has the right to return to Canada, but he's caught in a catch-22. Canada refuses to issue him a new passport. Our government graciously offers him a one-way travel document to return, but it's valid only for air travel. Air Canada has been warned by Foreign Affairs not to carry this man. The victim has been placed on America's dreaded no-fly list, so no airline will carry him, even if he takes a route that does not touch U.S. soil. This is another instance of the extraterritorial reach of American law. He could theoretically be flown directly to Canada, but Harper's boys are stonewalling on this, preferring to keep him a virtual prisoner in our Khartoum embassy. These basic facts have been known for some time, but recently released classified documents reveal the motivation behind our government's reticence to repatriate one of our own citizens. Within a heavily censored document is contained this statement: "Continued cooperation between Canada and the U.S. in matters of security is essential. We will need to continue to work closely on issues related to security of North America, including the case of Mr. Abdelrazik. Transport Canada and other senior Government of Canada officials should be mindful of the potential reaction of our U.S. counterparts to Abdelrazik's return to Canada, as he is on the U.S. no-fly list and the Department of Treasury's specially designated nationals and blocked persons. The obvious translation from bureaucratese is, we will hold this Canadian citizen in Sudan at the pleasure of the United States government, and his charter right to return to Canada be damned. The victim's Ottawa lawyer opines that Canada is happy to keep his client halfway around the world. He's at the mercy of the Americans, says his lawyer. These days of Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and resurrected medieval tortures, we know how shallow is the mercy of the Bush regime, but I would have expected more respect from Canada for the rights of our citizens, even under the sycophantic leadership of Stephen Harper. Harper's respect for our precious rights as citizens is fragile indeed. We all know where the United States stands on torture these days. We've seen the evidence. But what is Canada's attitude? We're a kinder, caring society which believes that cute animals, except for seals, and not-so-cute humans, should not be abused. We have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Dream on. The official attitude toward torture has been revealed by our foreign affairs officials' statements regarding the treatment of Abdelrazik in the Sudan prison. It's admitted that he was imprisoned there at Canada's request. It is acknowledged that he was flogged with a rubber hose on the back, head, and legs in the presence of Canadian officials. In response to his lawyer's accusation that this was torture and his confessions were extracted under extreme duress, foreign affairs stated, understandably, conditions in Sudanese prisons are very difficult, but this does not amount to torture or mistreatment. If beating with a rubber hose is neither torture nor mistreatment when inflicted on Canadians in Sudan, will it one day not be a violation of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms when used on Canadians at home? This was the story of those clamping down on our freedom of movement were eagerly awaiting. A lunatic on a Greyhound bus attacked and beheaded a fellow passenger. Since airline passengers have been completely subdued by paranoids and their technological toys, intruding on the privacy of passengers and their possessions, there's been a perceived need by governments to tighten up on the lesser classes who are reduced to travel by land. For too long, people have been able to shift around the country freely and anonymously by train and bus without informing Big Brother. This promises to end. This bus incident will mark the beginning of introduction of metal detectors and baggage searches in bus and train terminals. One sweet day, you will not be able to take a bus to Vancouver without providing photo identification. Bags will be searched for anthrax and weapons, not to mention narcotics, unclean underwear, and unapproved books. Once they have the public transport market under complete surveillance, watch for them to go after private autos. They already have license plate sensors. In some jurisdictions, it will give police instant identification of the owners. Ah, if George Orwell were just alive today. I cannot think of a greater waste of resources short of war than an air show. The exercise of burning vast amounts of petroleum to fly airplanes in circles for sheer entertainment is ridiculous at a time when we're supposed to be concerned with conserving oil and reducing greenhouse gases. I've seen two of these shows, the first of which was presented by the U.S. Air Force over Panama City's bay. Their Blue Angels put on a demonstration of air power which intimidated the locals, but not my fellow American soldiers watching. This demonstration proved to have been a prelude to the bombing of Panama as part of the American invasion 30 years later. That bombing destroyed the very neighborhood from which I had watched that air show. My second air show was Prince George's last. That show, dominated by U.S. Air Force killing machines, showcased, if I may use that hackneyed term, the A-10 Warthog, a flying death machine of awesome, in the original sense of the word, capabilities for spreading mayhem. I wondered at that time whether this show, like my first, might have been a preview of coming attractions here in British Columbia, if we don't follow orders from our imperial masters. But those experiences are not what I want to talk about. A recent air show in Farnborough outside London billed itself as a demonstration of how the aviation industry is cleaning up its act. The tale of a giant Airbus A380, one of those that will pack 555 souls aboard, carried a message in green on its eight-story tail reading, "A Better Environment Inside and Out." For hours on end, over several days, jets roared in and out of Farnborough, spewing pollution of gases and noise, all in the interest of convincing the masses that aviation was cleaning up its act. Presentation of acts by jet planes to promote a clean environment seems to me like dumping garbage in a stream to promote clean drinking water. So a few rocks fell on the Sea to Sky Highway. Big deal. We have nothing to fear but fear itself, like fears engendered by the collapse of housing prices and or the effects of Canfor's abandonment of its plywood operations in Prince George. Of course, there may be some people, like my wife, who now have misgivings about driving that road when going to Vancouver, and there may be many others who will question the wisdom of driving Highway 99 during the 2010 Olympics. The Vancouver Bid Committee promised those on the Olympian Committee that the route would be safe for the Games, but will it? Since Highway 99 was carved from a mountainside in the 60s, one person has died in rock slides on average every 10 years. Pretty good odds for drivers, since at least 10 times that number have been killed in collisions with cars, not rocks, in the same period. The odds of winning the 649 are higher than the being killed by a rock slide on this road. Anyone who has endured the stretch between North Vancouver and Whistler knows that it is infested with reckless drivers of luxury vehicles. Maniacs, perhaps holding too much faith in divine protection, pass on blind curves and double yellow lines. Tailgating drives me to distraction every time I take this route. Will drivers show more caution when confronted with hordes of Olympic visitors? Not bloody likely, but those hordes may not appear if the irrational fear of rock slides overcomes the rational fear of crazy drivers. My experience in the U.S. Army taught me that the officer class takes care of its own, and a class it was, apart from that of enlisted men. Official segregation of races had ended in the U.S. forces, but the segregation of the officer class from the enlisted class was palpable. We had to honor officers with salutes and the title of sir. I came to understand that sir had as much meaning as the title honorable means when applied to sleazy members of parliament. Just as in the segregated South there were separate toilet facilities for white and blacks, so the Army had toilets for officers and men, a separation that was a source of amusement to those of us acknowledged as men. I see that the Canadian military is no different from the American in having an officer class that takes care of its own. Colonel Serge Labay commanded the Canadian Airborne Regiment during the Somalia mission, which went fatally awry. He was twice denied promotion to Brigadier General since then, but now, on the verge of retirement, his superiors have bestowed this coveted rank on Colonel Labay. Now, not only is he to retire with the general rank and a superior pension, but the promotion was backdated to 2000, so his pension will be based on his best 5 years of pay in that period. No comments have been forthcoming as to what the good ex-general will do with his windfall 8 years of back pay, but I suspect it will provide the cushion he needs to maintain his coddled lifestyle until he settles into a cushy job with a right-wing think tank or lobbying firm. How sweet it is when you are in a class above mere men. With American stock markets in free fall, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has isolated the problem at the root of the fiasco. We'd been led to believe that there were other factors driving the collapse, but we were wrong, according to these worthies. This situation was not caused by greedy investment bankers trading dubious bits of debt. It was not due to the deregulation of markets and somnolent regulators. It was not due to a rogue government driving the nation trillions of dollars into debt with ruinous wars. It was not due to that government's policies on trade and finance, which have deindustrialized the former powerhouse of world manufacturing. No, the cause of falling stock prices is gossip. Yes, nefarious short sellers and hedge funds spread rumors of pending downtrends, and which actually caused them. The short sellers were thus able to cover their borrowings with devalued stocks and make a killing. For instance, before the drastic fall in values of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, rumors were flying that their stock would plummet, and short sellers rushed in. Sure enough, their values crashed. Naturally, this had nothing to do with the fact that both institutions were sitting on billions of dollars in worthless debt, thus rendering themselves technically bankrupt. It was rumors of the bankruptcy preventing the inflated stock from continuing to fly. Yes, sir, now that the culprits have been found out, the head of the SEC has pledged that he will crack down on misinformation spread largely via the Internet. If they could stop rumors, Would this restore the fundamental values behind stocks that have proven to be hollow? Is this a prelude to increased surveillance of free speech and the internet? Who knows outside of the mandarins of the Department of Homeland Paranoia and the Securities Exchange Commission? But if they think they can stop rumors, they should have their urine tested for suspicious substances. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. The Bush regime continues to demand that Iran dismantle its uranium enrichment facilities. They say that Iran must be planning to build nuclear weapons, that is, it's sitting on one of the world's most massive pools of petroleum and therefore has no need to extract energy from uranium. Maybe Iran crunched the numbers and found it more economical to export oil at over $100 a barrel than to burn it to produce electricity. Rather than build billion-dollar refineries to break down their petroleum, it might be cheaper to send out the raw oil and import needed gasoline and other byproducts. It could be a rational decision for the long term that Iran build the capacity to harness its own uranium resources for electrical power instead of burning their lucrative oil. But the Bush regime won't let facts interfere with ideologically driven ambition. Is it not ironic that when the U.S. intends to push for increased sanctions on Iran by restricting its imports of gasoline, Iran lacks adequate capacity to refine enough of its own oil and is second only to the U.S. as an importer of gasoline? No, it's not ironic. This is just an ongoing reaction to the U.S. humiliation when 63 hostages were held in the American embassy from 1979 until 1981. A key demand then was that the U.S. return the Shah, then in exile in the United States, for trial. They wanted to see this Western-installed dictator held to account for his government's crime. Incidentally, the hostage takers demanded that the U.S. make an undertaking not to meddle in Iranian affairs anymore. Neither demand was met, especially the latter. There's been continuity through the presidencies of Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and now Bush the Lesser to punish Iran. Rationalizations for persecution change with time and regime, but the motive remains the same. Until Iran installs an American-friendly regime and opens its oil fields to U.S. corporations, Washington will find reasons to make life miserable for Iranians. A few months ago, I corresponded by email with the daughter of a Cuban couple we met while visiting the island. When we last saw our friends, this daughter, now a woman, was in grade school. She's now a university student with aspirations to immigrate to Canada or the United States. She has an aunt living in Las Vegas who visited the family in Cuba with glowing tales of the glitter and wealth to be had in North America. I'm afraid I rained on her parade when I gave her my take on life for an average Hispanic immigrant in either of our countries. I made no secret of my distaste for Las Vegas in particular and the way our society treats the less fortunate in general. I've not heard back from the woman. I could have pointed out some of the facts recounted in a recent issue of the Guardian Weekly concerning American society in the 21st century. It's common in American cities to find Latinos on selected street corners soliciting for day work at any price. They live by lawn work, odd jobs, or construction. These people, mostly men and many undocumented, lead precarious lives on the fringes of society. They live in fear of sickness, injury, or the dreaded immigration enforcers. There are 12 to million of them in the U.S. And where does the U.S. stand in terms of life expectancy in the world? It's number 42. Behind almost every other developed country. It has a higher percentage of its children living in poverty than any of those other countries. 40 million Americans lack basic literacy. There are two Americas, one affluent and the other poor. They're separate and seldom overlap except where the wealthy step over the homeless sleeping on their streets or hire them by the day to clean their swimming pools. In wealthy Connecticut, the life expectancy is 30 years more than in poverty-stricken Mississippi. Among candidates for president, none but John Edwards offered any hope for the poor. All other major contenders, Obama, Clinton, and McCain, played to the affluent while treating the poor, as the rich always do, by ignoring them and their problems in stratified America. Candidates play to the stranded mortgage holder and the frustrated driver, not those with no homes, mortgages, or cars. I wish that any candidate would face the issue of the world's largest economy having such poor social statistics. No longer the shining city on the hill that it professed to be, it is now a haven for the rich and a hell for the poor. The verb and noun forms of the word challenge have many meanings. Most commonly, they refer to a dare, to a contest, or trial of superiority. But these words have taken on new meanings in our 21st century world of euphemism. People who used to be dumb are now mentally challenged. Those with bodily infirmities are physically challenged. As for me, at one time I used to be going deaf, and I now find that I am only hearing challenged. In a recent news report on the Canfor decision to abandon plywood production in Prince George, the headline read, "Market faces challenges," company says. Within the body of the article, we learned that there was going to be a challenge on fiber in Prince George. In terms of markets for plywood, the future would be challenging as well. The facility which burned lost money in the last quarter and faced future market challenges. In regard to placing to the 260 employees whose jobs burned with the plant, they will be hard to place, as it's a very challenging time for the company. I challenge those who speak for corporations and those who write newspaper articles to find a suitable word to replace the misused and abused word, challenge. In the same newspaper as the foregoing article, is a story that our provincial government is seeking to recoup $6.8 million it lent Ripudaman Singh Malik for his legal costs in defending himself at the Air India bombing trial. Interesting it is that our government was able to be so generous to a man who supposedly had $10 million in assets at the time of his arrest. Be that as it may, this story rests uncomfortably above a photo of homeless people camped rough in a Vancouver park. Some of them have been awarded $75 tickets by the police for the crime of sleeping on public property. Our treasury has deep pockets when it comes to handing our cash to a man accused of murdering 331 innocent people, but it hasn't the wherewithal to put a roof over the heads of Vancouver's destitute. Not only that, but it levies fines on these people. I suppose each one will be able to pay his or her fine by scrounging only 1,500 pop bottles cast off by the likes of wealthy Ripudaman Singh Malik. Those dealing with nuclear waste have a problem. Radioactive residue from reactors and weapons making must be disposed of in a manner that will not affect the chosen people or their descendants. This, of course, excludes those unchosen locations like Iraq, where radioactive debris, reclassified as depleted, can be strewn about as ammunition. There are various schemes for long-term underground storage of radioactive waste in areas that appear to be geologically stable. But in the long term, is any place on our thin shell of solid land, riding around the planet on tectonic plates, stable? Consider the humans first broke sod a mere 10,000 years ago, and then look at the fact that our nuclear waste will be a deadly legacy for many thousands of generations into the future. What changes will the human race undergo in that time span? We have no idea. Unless we come to our collective senses, this question will be moot, as we will have destroyed our species and perhaps all life on the planet in a short time, geologically speaking. Assuming that the human race will continue to infest the planet into the distant future and that our stockpiles of radioactive residue continue to grow, how can we indicate to future civilization that these storage areas are dangerous? For all we know, the uninformed will dig up our secure areas and poison themselves in their environment. We must indicate the danger to people who may have no knowledge of our language or warning signs. There's serious work going on with psychologists, linguists, and God knows what specialists attempting to devise such warnings. There's been no consensus so far. One candidate for a signal is the familiar skull and crossbones, as seen in decorating the clothing, tattoos, and vehicles of the unwashed. An experiment was conducted in which the skull and crossbones symbol was presented to preschoolers. When on a bottle, the symbol evoked the response of poison. But when portrayed on a flat surface, they said pirates. And pirates these days are not portrayed as bloodthirsty outlaws, but as heroes. Scratch the skull and crossbones. The search goes on. You don't have to be an economic genius to realize that a massive increase in the money supply, outstripping a nation's productive capacity, will result in inflation. As more money chases limited goods, prices will rise. Under George Bush, the lesser, the United States government has been squandering vast amounts of money on two wars while cutting taxes that would have drained excess cash out of circulation. The result? massive deficits, ballooning foreign debt, and inflation. When they sent shrink-wrapped pallets of $100 bills off to be spread around Iraq, they knew that those notes would return to America. In any case, the chief economist for CIBC World Markets Incorporated predicts that chickens will be coming home to roost as a U.S. inflation rate of at least 6% by year-end. The Federal Reserve banks will be forced to raise interest rates in an effort to cool this before it becomes runaway, but the collapse of home prices and bank crises will put pressure on the government to lower interest rates while injecting more money into supporting the whole credit system. In his 7 years in office, Bush and his blind ideologues have built this crisis brick by brick. When they inherited or stole office, the economy was humming and Clinton had left behind a huge budget surplus. Every indicator pointed to action needed to cool the economy, paying down debt and deflating the housing and credit bubbles that were building. George's geniuses decided instead to reward their supporters by cutting taxes while embarking on expensive wars. Soon the budget was in deep deficit, running currently to $500 billion a year. In essence, George has managed to screw the people of the United States, present and future. Of course, I mean the real people, the ones who do the work that keeps the country going. His rich friends have stockpiled so much money and are adding to it so fast that the prospect of 6% inflation doesn't faze them. They will ride above the hoi polloi, maintaining their profligate lifestyles as average families struggle to feed themselves and their vehicles. Here in Canada, we have our own precious Stephen Harper, George's Me Too man. He squanders our resources in an endless war against Afghanistan while cutting taxes. A government which rode into minority power promising transparency and fiscal probity is now hiding its every action while running a budget deficit. Will we regain sanity and elect a responsible replacement for Harper's bozos? Not likely. His adversary Dion is promoting a carbon tax that would be a small step toward facing climate disaster while bringing some fiscal sanity to Ottawa. Harper's propaganda screams tax grab. Yes, what we need is a tax grab and a grab from those with the excess cash inflating prices. Before attacking the Bush regime for foolishness, we should take a serious look at our worthy representatives in Ottawa. Senator McCain is not saying whether his right-wing faith in the markets would lead him to continue with George Wanker Bush's campaign to sell off the Social Security system. He's shy on this issue, as the stock market's tanks and those who put their faith in mutual fund IRAs see their prospects for early retirement evaporate. McCain has an incentive to protect the elderly, as he's now 71 years of age and has been collecting Social Security benefits of $1,930 a month for 6 years. Not that this would damage his lifestyle, as his wife Cindy is reputed to be worth $100 million on the hoof. This has been the 278th Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. I'm Uncle Don, and you may be able to catch rebroadcasts on CJLY in Nelson Kootenay Lake and CHLS in Lillooet. Sleep tight.